You're listening to Let's Talk Macro,
brought to you by Bandhan Mutual Fund.
Another episode of Let's Talk Macro by Bandhan Mutual Fund resumes. Welcome back to the podcast on macroeconomics, everybody. Ahalya here, keeping you company as we discuss interesting global and domestic macroeconomic topics, as always. And to help us through another interesting, detailed, comprehensive conversation is, of course, Srijit Balasubramanian, economist in the Fixed Income Fund Management team. Hi, Srijit. Thank you so much for being with us once again. Couldn't do this without you.
Hi, Ahalya. How are you?
I'm good. And you've brought to the table a pretty unique conversation today, Srijit. We're going to be looking at the euro area, but also the UK. We've often discussed India, the global economy, particularly the US. In fact, in our last episode, and for everyone who hasn't heard it, please go listen to that because it provides a very important perspective on how the US economy is kind of affecting macroeconomics now. But yeah, we did talk about the data so far this year and, you know, whether it suggests a hard, soft, or no landing. Today, we're going to be talking about, of course, the other side of the coin, metaphorically so, the European economy, right? Central banks in various advanced economies are expected to embark on their interest rate cut cycle with differing starting points and magnitudes. And the European Central Bank, the ECB, is keenly being looked at for signals and actions. So today, we're going to discuss the economic context in the euro area and the UK, the progress in disinflation, what their central bank are thinking and their likely path ahead and how it's going to differ with that of the US Fed. Srijit, before we get into this, tell us a little bit about why you decided to talk about the euro area and the progress being made there. Is it something that we need to keep a close eye on?
Yeah, so actually the euro area has been witnessing lower growth for quite some time compared to the US. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a major part of the economic situation now across most of the world reflects what happened during the pandemic. The policy response to it, be it fiscal or monetary, in addition to, of course, the structure of the economy itself.
Yeah.
Now, we know from the US experience how heavy fiscal stimulus during the pandemic in the form of unemployment insurance and cash transfers, and then lack of consolidation of fiscal deficit to pre-pandemic levels thereafter, created strong consumer demand and household savings. You know, we've talked about this before. Overall, direct fiscal response in the euro area, however, was much lower. Now, despite some divergence and challenges within the bloc, and this response was more towards buffering consumers from energy price rise. So this is the primary reason we see growth, wealth effect, and consumer demand being relatively lower here. Now, in terms of monetary policy, the ECB's deposit rate was already, you know, negative at minus 0.5% before the pandemic. So it didn't really cut rates further, unlike the Fed, which could cut its policy rate by 150 basis points to take it to zero at the first place. The Fed's balance sheet response, that is, you know, increase, was also heavier and faster. In terms of composition too, if you look at it, the Fed resorted to more outright purchases of treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities, which pumped money into the economy, while the ECB relied more on targeted long-term refinancing operations, which were called the TLTROs, that provide conditional long-term financing to credit institutions, and then, you know, that stimulates lending to the real economy. So what I'm trying to essentially say here is that the fiscal stimulus was lower, and even the monetary policy response was a bit different in the euro area in terms of the impact it had on private demand. The other difference in monetary policy is during the rate hike side, and that's important too, you know, because in terms of the impact it had on the US and euro area economies. The Fed started hiking rates in March 2022, and the ECB started 4 months later in July. The Fed hiked rates by, you know, about 525 basis points, while the ECB by 450 basis points. So the ECB effectively started a bit later and hiked a little lesser. But that is something which, again, depends on various factors, right? Also, one important difference here is on monetary policy transmission based on the share of variable rate loans. And I think that's one very important difference that one needs to understand. And the Fed hiked by around 525 basis points, while the ECB hiked by 450 basis points. So the ECB started a bit later and hiked a bit lesser, but that is something which depends on various domestic factors, right? So in Europe, for example, the share of variable rate loans, particularly for mortgages, and therefore transmission is higher, versus the US where, you know, fixed rate 30-year mortgages are very common. Now, apart from interest rates, the ECB's balance sheet has decreased by around 28% from its peak in US dollar terms, you know, if you see the latest numbers. As the TLTRO repayments have also happened. At the same time, the Fed's balance sheet has fallen only by around 17%. So both fiscal and monetary policies in terms of the immediate response to the pandemic and its reversal were more measured and timely in the euro area. And this difference in policy has contributed to the relatively lower growth in Europe. So this is, of course, apart from the more fundamental difference between the two economies and productivity and so on.
Okay, I mean, that's a pretty valuable insight there, Srijit. You know, the fiscal and monetary policies in response to the pandemic and the reversal thereafter kind of driving this growth differential that we're witnessing now. But given these drivers, what is the kind of data we have seen recently coming out of Europe, specifically in the areas of growth, inflation? Could you maybe talk us through that?
Sure. On inflation, headline growth in the euro area peaked above 10% sometime heading in October 2022. A few months after the peak in US inflation, because energy price dynamics in the euro area was more impactful, you know, given higher imports and dependence on Russia. So goods inflation in the euro area peaked later and at a higher point. But thereafter, the disinflation goods progressed quite well, and it is now very close to that in the US. Services inflation had also peaked later, but was much lower even then compared to the US. Again, the US faced much stronger consumer demand due to the fiscal stimulus we spoke about. Service inflation now in the euro area is around 4% higher than pre-pandemic, and this could ease further, but it's still lower than the 5% that we're seeing in the US right now. And overall, if you see, you know, headline inflation was around 2.4%, I think last month in April, in the euro area versus 3.4% in the US, and core inflation is also lower. And if you see by country also, you know, inflation in France and Germany have eased to under 2.5%, while in Italy it has eased much more to around 1%. It's quite broad-based. That's on inflation. And second, on growth, first we need to understand, you know, the euro area is more reliant on manufacturing than the US. So the share of manufacturing in overall output is around, let's say, I think around 17% versus it's, you know, 10% in the US. And the second thing is, like, a, you know, a country like Germany has a major share in this. So 35% of the manufacturing output in the euro area is only from Germany. So as an economic and monetary union, the structure, the dependence and divergence among the member countries make it a very different growth story. In terms of data, again to your question, so we had euro area GDP growing by around 0.4% year on year in the March quarter that just went by, after growing, you know, I think 0.1% in the previous two quarters. Credit growth has been slowing. Industrial production growth has been mostly negative for some time, and that continues. Manufacturing PMI has been in the contractionary zone for quite some time, and it has also sort of directionally moderated in the last few months, you know, after some improvement we saw in the second half of last year. On the other hand, if you look at services side, so if you look at services PMI, for example, that has picked up in the last few months. Growth in retail sales value has been moderating, but volume growth, although it's been negative for a while, has sort of directionally improved, in fact, turned positive in March. So this is true even if you exclude auto and fuel and so on. So the volume growth is looking pretty okay of late. Consumer confidence has moved up a bit. So the overall picture is quite mixed, with services doing most of the lifting.
Okay, so from that, we can sort of surmise that, you know, progress on disinflation and economic growth are likely bottoming out, although primarily led by services. But given, you know, these two factors, Srijit, I think it's also important for us to consider the labor market, especially, you know, in our US conversation, we spoke in quite a bit of detail about the labor market and the situation there. So how is the European area labor market performing? How has it evolved? Is it still tight? And what is that, you know, market's impact on inflation currently?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked about the labor market, because it's very closely linked to the services sector we just spoke about. So services by definition is less capital and more labor intensive. So services doing okay means labor market is getting some support, which has been the case. At the headline level, if you see, the unemployment rate has fallen to well below pre-pandemic levels. But at the same time, job vacancies of late across sectors have moderated. Wage growth was less than expected in the December quarter, and this could move on further too. So overall labor market tightness is in fact easing. Now, there are some important aspects here. One is labor productivity growth, which has been quite low in the Europe. So if that continues to stay low, unit labor costs, so often defined as the ratio of compensation per employee to labor productivity. So unit labor costs will be high if productivity is low. So, and that's not good. Second is how much of the growth in labor costs gets absorbed by companies in their profit margins. Now, this is again more important in the services sector, and probably matters more in the near term for, you know, further progress on disinflation.
You know what, Srijit, I think in this conversation, you've also suddenly revealed the secret to why everyone's always being made to be productive. I don't know if people will be so happy with that, but at least we have some kind of clarity there. Okay, so the labor market tightness is easing, which to some people may or may not be a good thing. I do want to digress a little bit at this point in the conversation from just the euro area to the United Kingdom specifically, which is no longer part of the union thanks to Brexit, but of course is an important economy, right? I remember we spoke about in one of our podcasts some of the economic issues within the UK, but what's it looking like now? And, you know, I'm sure it has close links to, of course, the situation in the European area as well. So what is the growth inflation dynamic in the UK specifically?
So the UK faced issues from labour shortage, tax cuts in the 2022 mini budget, which wasn't well received by the markets. And then, of course, high inflation and low growth for most part of last year, even compared to the euro area. But more recently, if you see, there's been a turn. So real GDP grew around, I think, 0.2% year on year in the March quarter, that is, after minus 0.2% in the December quarter. And in fact, it just grew, like, I think, by around 0.1% for the whole of 2023. The other important point, in fact, is that the unemployment rate is close to pre-pandemic levels after inching up in the last few months, while weekly earnings growth is moderating. House price growth has fallen in March and it was actually flat in April. And I think more significantly, inflation, which peaked at over, I think, 11% sometime in late 2022, has now fallen to the vicinity of 3%, which is quite sharp. And core inflation, I think, is around 4%. So it's great progress on disinflation. And some progress on labor markets and some still very early signs of growth bottoming out in the UK.
Okay, so there have obviously been some turnaround in terms of progress on disinflation and easier labor markets. But before we get to the ECB, could you also talk about the Bank of England, the BOE's assessment of the economy, and what is the likely path there on monetary policy? Be a mind reader for us. Any changes since the progress that you've mentioned that you see coming soon?
Yes, like I said, the UK has been considered an outlier even within Europe because of its high inflation. In fact, in a recent speech by the BOE's deputy governor, he explained why it is likely not an outlier, but more of a laggard based on recent inflation prints, which is now quickly catching. This is because the timing of UK's energy interventions relative to the other European countries prolonged the impact of high energy prices on UK inflation there. So, for example, the first main fall in household energy price cap happened only in October last year. So as growth in energy prices and, you know, headline inflation fell after that, inflation expectations started to moderate. And this, in turn, has not put pressure on wage growth, which has been weakened. Even the preferred measure of job vacancies to unemployment ratio is now at pre-pandemic levels. What I'm essentially trying to say here is that the labor market is loosening, and this again is feeding into weaker services inflation, which sort of broadens the disinflationary impact there. Thus, the persistence in upside skew to inflation, which the BOE projected earlier in 2023 from services price pressures and geopolitical events, hasn't really materialized or materialized to a much lesser extent. The Monetary Policy Committee, in its meeting earlier this month, said recent inflation prints were encouraging, and that inflation is in fact likely to fall to its 2% target in a couple of months, which is great. And this is because it now expects the underlying inflationary pressures to fade a bit faster than previously assumed. But it obviously also said that it needs more evidence to ensure inflation will continue to stay low. In fact, even on growth, it estimates GDP growth of only 0.5% in 2024 this year and 1% next year. So there is faster than expected disinflation. There is looser labor markets and very benign growth. So because of all these factors, in the meeting this month, we had one more vote, which is by the deputy governor himself. So total 2 votes for a rate cut versus 7 for a hold. In fact, in the press conference, the governor said the rate cuts cannot be ruled out in the next meeting in June, which is hardly a month away. In fact, that total cuts in the coming quarters could be more than what markets are pricing in. And markets are currently pricing in around 2+ cuts, as in mid-May. Yeah. So that's where we are.
Nice, Srijit. I mean, I think we might have to do a podcast soon on just the UK, because there seems to be quite a bit of change in that economic situation, right, on both the inflation and monetary policy fronts.
But that's
for probably next time. In that context, maybe we'll come back to the euro area now. We did talk about progress here as well on inflation and the labor market. But now on to the bank, right? What is the ECB's assessment of the economic situation, their outlook? What are their predicted moves moving forward? And and how is it different in approach from the Fed, if at all? And what do you think are going to be the implications for monetary policy and interest rates in the coming months?
So if you remember, the Fed's last rate hike in this cycle was in July last year, while the ECB's was in September. So then the Fed obviously pivoted in December when it said disinflation has progressed well, you know, policy rates have likely peaked in this cycle, and that it has started discussing on the timing of policy rate cuts. It also projected 75 basis points of rate cuts in 2024 this year, and markets started to price in even more. But the ECB actually continued to sound relatively more hawkish, you know, at that point in time. But in a turn of events, US data surprised to the upside in the March quarter, and market had to dial back its rate cut expectations. On the other hand, the ECB started guiding on rate cuts. So that's how it really progressed. But now if you look at the ECB's latest assessment on growth, manufacturing has been weak, especially in energy intensive sectors, but spending on services has been resilient. It expects a gradual recovery led by services. No, in fact, also by exports and less drag by monetary policy as real incomes rise due to lower inflation and increased wages. However, it sees the overall risk to growth is still tilted to the downside, you know, although real GDP growth is expected to pick up next year. Bank credit demand has been easing, and in fact, lending standards have also been tightening. So during the March quarter, this is particularly so for firms and contrary to banks' expectations of a recovery. And apparently, according to the survey, this was driven by high interest rates and the fall in fixed investments. So the main point there is that credit dynamics remain weak. In fact, the ECB also reiterated the need to roll back energy-related fiscal support measures and to fully and quickly implement the revised economic governance framework there so that governments can sustainably bring down, you know, the fiscal deficits in their respective countries.
Okay, so I think, again, an interesting point in the conversation, Shijit. So you mentioned earlier that fiscal stimulus was lesser in the European area compared to the US, right? But in an absolute sense, when we're looking at the entire global macroeconomic picture, how is it placed? And is there visible progress in relation to not just the US, but, you know, the bigger picture?
Yeah, so the combined fiscal deficit in the euro area was only around 0.5% of GDP before the pandemic. It averaged 6%, you know, during the pandemic, that is 2020 and 2021. And this is projected by the ECB to be around just above 3% in 2023, but it printed a bit higher. And it is currently projected to moderate to less than 3%, I think 2.8% in the next 2 years. But this could be revised given the higher 2023 number. So, in fact, the point here really is that the fiscal deficit to GDP is better than that in the US. But it hasn't gone back to pre-pandemic rates. And it has also printed a bit higher than expected of late. So during the ECB's April meeting, concerns were expressed about the upward revisions recently. But the new fiscal framework to be in place, which sort of provides guidelines and, you know, sort of guiding principles and raises prospects for more credible implementation, was widely considered to be good for monetary policy. So some countries, even France and Italy, will definitely need fiscal consolidation under the excessive deficit procedure that gets triggered there. And there could be challenges because, you know, spending post-pandemic has become a bit more rigid and the impact of inflation on tax revenues start to wane, you know, which is where growth, investment, etc. become important. The ECB will be closely looking at the fiscal policies, therefore, how the framework functions and how sort of the progress goes ahead in countries in consolidating their deficits and debt, the impact all this will have on growth and inflation. But one thing to remember here is the ECB has tools, apart from interest rates, to handle fragmentation risk to monetary policy transmission within the euro area. What I mean by this is that if, for example, countries within the bloc pursue different or divergent fiscal policies, but this reflects as unwarranted and disorderly market dynamics, you know, which is not justified by country-specific fundamentals, for example, say in the form of lower liquidity or wider spreads in some markets, then the ECB can consider using its so-called transmission protection instrument. And this was introduced in 2022 and provides flexibility on secondary market purchases of securities. And that flexibility is across time, jurisdiction, products. So this allows the ECB to focus on its price stability mandate and, you know, counter risk to monetary policy transmission. Of course, you know, certain conditions are to be met and assessments will be made before deploying this instrument.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, one of the most obvious sort of inferences that I have at least come too, through all of our conversations on the series so far, Shijit, is that, you know, one size definitely doesn't fit all, especially when you're talking about world economies, right? So even for the euro area, some fiscal consolidation is needed, but it is a very different situation from the US. And I guess only time will tell how each situation pans out, right? Getting back to the ECB's economic assessment, what is it specifically on the outlook for the labor market in the euro area and therefore on inflation that you think we need to keep a close eye on? Do you think that correlation has changed more recently?
So unemployment rate is at an all-time low, but job vacancies are falling. Labor demand is easing. Wages and even profits grew less than expected in the December quarter, and the ECB expects further moderation, although it may not be linear. Now, this is the main factor behind its expectation of inflation falling to 2%, which is their target in 2025. One, some of the members think the labor market support to the economy has sort of reached its limit because, you know, labor supply has already increased quite a bit, and a turn in the labor market cycle could lead to lesser hiring and more layoffs. Two, it is true that the services sector is more labor intensive and there is uncertainty on their further capacity to absorb higher wage costs in their profit margins and thus the impact on services inflation. But what recent data suggests is that price pressures in services were not actually from the more wage-sensitive items. But it is actually from items typically affected by change in pricing at the start of the year, you know, like insurance and services with administered prices. So this is broadly the thinking behind their weaker wage growth projections. Now, on inflation, as we said, most measures are easing, but there are some domestic price pressures and, you know, therefore services inflation is strong. ECB expects inflation to fluctuate around current levels and then to gradually decline to 2% mid of next year. In fact, expected inflation has declined since their last rate hike in September. So it essentially implies further tightening through, you know, higher real rates, which is currently, I think, close to the peak of the cycle. So it now thinks there could be a risk of inflation expectations, in fact, becoming unanchored to the downside if the current weak growth persists. So what they essentially, you know, again, what they're trying to say is the risk of undershooting the inflation target and slowing down growth is now seen to be at least as high as the risk of overshooting the target in the medium. So there's more balance. So it now considers the risk of doing too much to tame inflation at par with that of doing too little. This is actually quite important in terms of the change in their thinking.
Yeah, and it feels like a fair bit of change in the labor and inflation situation, and therefore also the ECB's assessment of how it can go from there. And that brings us, of course, to, you know, probably the main question of this entire thing. Given all that we have discussed on the euro area, what do you think is the ECB's latest outlook on monetary policy?
Like we said, ECB thinks higher real rates have tightened financial conditions. Credit demand is weak. Risk to growth is to the downside. Labor market should loosen further and most measures of inflation have moderated. You know, although services inflation is room to ease, they're not going to wait until everything goes back to 2% to make the first move on policy. Inflation in some items will be slightly higher and progress is not going to be linear. So taking all this into consideration, I think in their April monetary policy statement, they added that if their updated assessment of the inflation outlook, dynamics of underlying inflation and strength of monetary policy transmission were to further increase their confidence that inflation is in fact converging to the 2% target in a sustained manner, it will be appropriate for them to reduce the current level of monetary policy restriction. So given their next meeting is now in June and that more labor and inflation data, and in fact their updated official projections will also be available, it is very likely the ECB could kick off rate cuts in June. In fact, given progress in labor market and inflation is expected to be gradual and not, you know, simply quick and steady, the market is currently pricing in around 3 rate cuts this year. That is 3 25 basis points rate cuts, one every quarter starting in June. So that seems quite fair. And this compares to around, you know, 2.5 cuts priced in roughly of late by the market for UK and around 2 cuts for the US, obviously starting a bit later now given stronger data.
Okay, so 3 interest rate cuts by the ECB is what the market is currently expecting. We've definitely covered a lot in today's episode and quite deeply on the euro area. You know what? They say good things come to those who wait, right? So yes, the euro area has waited, but we have delivered on today's podcast. One last question for you, Shijit, on the policy action of central banks around the world being tied to that of the Fed. The ECB and BOE are likely to move sooner rather than later, and this could happen before before the Fed cuts, right? Typically, we hear a lot about monetary policy around the world being tied to the US Fed's actions. What are your thoughts? Do you think it's going to be the same old, or are we going to witness something new maybe this time?
The difference is clearly weaker growth and more recent progress on inflation compared to the US. So this is because of the difference in the drivers of inflation, where it is more strongly driven by demand factors in the US, while its supply factors in Europe. This again goes back to the difference of higher fiscal stimulus in the US, and so private consumption, demand and investments being very different. The other factor we discussed is that monetary policy transmission is also likely better in the euro area, given their high share of variable rate loans. So it's not surprising the ECB said it is data dependent and not really Fed dependent. Now, this is a clear example of policy divergence versus the US in 2024. So we've already seen in our 25 basis points cut in Switzerland, where inflation has been below 2% for some months and is expected to average, I think, around only 1.4% this year and 1.2% next year. Growth is also expected to remain modest in the coming quarters. Another example is Sweden, which has also cut, I think, rates by 25 basis points this month. Even there, inflation is approaching the target while economic activity is weak. The central bank said if the inflation outlook holds, there could be two more rate cuts this year. So this year could be one of monetary policy divergence from the Fed, and we're already seeing that. And that's really important for global rates this year and how it's different from last year. And finally, just to add, in the medium term, there are more considerations, obviously. So we've discussed about each economy's long-term neutral rate, which many believe have moved up after the pandemic, and fiscal policy, how it looks like going ahead for the various economies. All these will be important considerations. Now, for the euro area specifically, medium-term growth prospects and where the current low labor productivity settles will thus be really important for growth in unit labor costs, which is still high due to labor productivity. So the ECB expects productivity to recover soon, but for that, investments, innovation, factors related to capital and labor, all of that need to improve. Even in the near term, they often talk about the wages, profit, productivity cycle, which is all linked. So what I'm trying to say here is, in short, monetary policy divergence versus the Fed this year and more considerations in the medium term.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I think that wraps a pretty neat bow on today's conversation, Srijit. Thanks always for being with us and being our guiding light, in the world of macroeconomics. No, I do want to say, it kind of feels like we are at the start of a new season, right, of one of our favorite shows, which is at least on Let's Talk Macro, the global economy, because it does feel like we're at a turning point in many different ways, and different economies are going to be responding quite differently. It's going to be interesting to see who performs the best. I guess we'll be talking about that as well on the podcast. So just to sum it up, policy divergence versus the Fed this year, with Switzerland and Sweden having already cut rates in the euro area and UK likely to commence. And there's a lot of rationale behind this that can be linked all the way back to the fiscal and monetary stimulus during the pandemic, which was definitely higher in the US. We do see, however, that in the economic situation now, in the form of relatively slower growth, private consumption, credit demand, and progress in wage growth, and finally, of course, inflation, the underlying dynamics of which are quite different from that in the US. There's many other considerations, of course, and structural aspects of the economy also that matter in the medium term. So, like I said, feels like we're at waiting for the new season of our favorite show to start. On that note, I hope all of you found this detailed discussion on the euro area and UK and policy divergence this year very useful. Thanks, Srijit. And he and I will obviously be back soon. Yeah, with another episode of Let's Talk Macro. Until then, bye-bye.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully.